The 13th Candle by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 11. We seem to be quite international. We have had questions so far from Africa, India, Iran, England, so let's get one from nearer home, one from Quebec. The question is about retarded children. What purpose does a child have who is born retarded or even crippled or blind? I know that nothing is ever in vain, but I do not see the reason for all the retarded children we have in our society. I might sound cruel, but how can these poor souls learn anything? Are they not better off dead? And my answer is, some of these retarded children are born in their retarded condition because, before coming to the earth, they definitely chose that sort of life to gain that sort of experience. After all, how can you be acquainted with the sensations of a retarded child if you've never been one? And if you have never been a retarded child and recovered, how can you help retarded children? Other retarded children are cases which could be greatly improved. They may be caused by carelessness at birth or simply by bad training, often by elderly parents. But invariably, most of the latter class have a poor connection with the overself, and thus the messages are not properly relayed. Of course, there are in the world many people who should be sent home, just as one sends an animal home when it is obviously incurable. But it is one of those things which we just cannot do because public opinion is not yet in favor of it. In theory, it is the best thing to kill a person who is mentally retarded. In theory. In actuality, it would be impossible to distinguish between those who were incurable for the purpose of learning and those who actually are learning nothing but bitterness. There is a further point, and it is this. The person who is incurable today, and so a candidate for euthanasia, might be cured tomorrow or next week by the advancing sciences. A nice question, this, one which I am sure you will like, and it is this. To what extent should one be forgiving? The Bible says an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but this is inhuman. The man Jesus said, to forgive 70 times 7, yet this is impossible in today's life. How much tolerance should one give? Well, this is an answer which might make certain old ladies of either sex blush, but I have a rough rule for how much one should take. I know all about turning the other cheek, but really, you know, we only have 4 cheeks, 2 in the front and 2 behind. When all 4 have been slapped, then it's time to slap back. Much harder. And stop the nonsense once and for all, because to continuously sit back, meek and mild, and take all the abuse which is hurled at one, is just to prove oneself a ninny and a weakling and not worthy of any consideration at all. We should consider, are we man or mouse? If we are mouse, then squeak to your heart's delight, but run back into the woodwork out of the way. If you are a man or mankind, then if people go beyond certain limits, it is foolish to tolerate any more. Dr. Rampa, the letter started, you can look into the Akashic record, and you know what is going on. Tell me, what was the truth about the Shakespeare affair? Did Shakespeare write his books or what? Yes, for those who know how and who know how not to abuse it, the Akashic record is available for special purposes. But it doesn't really matter who Shakespeare was or why there is all the mystery. But here are some absolute facts. The poor farmer's boy, who was later to be known as Shakespeare, had a very great attribute. He had a frequency which was entirely compatible with an entity who needed to come to the earth to do a special task. So the boy, who was to be known as Shakespeare, was watched very carefully, watched as the careful gardener watches the blooming of a rare and precious plant. At the appropriate moment, arrangements were made whereby the entity then inhabiting the body of the person who was to be known as Shakespeare, the author, was released from what, to him, had become tiresome bondage. He didn't like the life of poverty, a life of hardship, and so it was easy to arrange that the entity controlling Shakespeare left, relinquished his control, and he passed on elsewhere. The entity who had this special task to do, and who for some considerable time had been seeking a suitable vehicle, because it is so wasteful for such high entities to have to come down and be reborn and risk losing much knowledge through the traumatic experience of birth, the entity looked for a suitable grown host, and when the time was ripe, the body was vacated by one and instantaneously reoccupied by the other. Now, there was a giant intellect in the body of the poor peasant, a giant intellect which had some considerable difficulty in adjusting to the confined space, in adjusting to the limited convolutions of the brain. And so, for a little time, there was a period of stasis during which no creative work was done. Then the giant entity controlling the peasant body set forth to London, set forth to explore, to become accustomed to the new body, and to overcome its gaucheries. With the passage of time, and as increasing familiarity had been acquired over the body and the brain, the entity began its task, writing immortal classics. But the writings were obviously impossible to an author of that body's apparent upbringing. So it is, throughout the years, there have been doubts, skepticisms, and wild surmises about who was Shakespeare, who wrote the works of Shakespeare. The answer? The entity who took over the body of Shakespeare wrote those works, because that was his task, and having accomplished his task, he departed, leaving behind him what to many is an enigma, a problem without solution. Yet, if mankind would only listen to others who've had similar experiences, they too would be able to consult the Akashic record and know something of the true marvels amid which we live. Here is another question, which may be of some interest, and it is, when you say patience is needed to achieve astral travel, do you mean weeks, months, or years? Or does the period vary widely according to the person concerned, the amount of time they've been practicing and the individual latent ability. Actually, astral travel is done by all of us. Most people are unconscious of it, and when they have an experience which they dimly remember in the morning, they put it down as a dream or imagination. Astral traveling, or rather learning to astral travel, is much the same as learning to ride a bicycle. Really, it sounds quite impossible that anyone should ever learn to ride on two wheels, and as for those unicycle things, well, people can learn to ride a bicycle or a unicycle. People can learn to walk a tightrope, and there's no set time for how long it's going to take one to become proficient. It is only a knack. If you believe you can ride a cycle, then you can ride a cycle. If you believe you can walk a tightrope, or a slack rope either, then you can do so. And it's the same with astral travel. It is not possible to set out a list of exercises on how you start to astral travel. How would you tell a person the manner in which he should learn to ride a bicycle? How would you tell a person how he would learn to use roller skates? Besides the obvious one of tying a cushion to his posterior, that is. And again, how would you teach a person how to breathe so that he could live? Breathing is a natural thing. We just do it. We're not always conscious of doing it, are we? We're only conscious of breathing when there is some difficulty. We are not conscious of astral traveling either, most of us. But it is just as easy as breathing, just as easy as riding a bicycle. The main thing is that you should decide that you're going to astral travel consciously. The emphasis is on the word consciously. Unfortunately, the word imagination has a bad name. People think that to imagine a thing is to pretend something which doesn't exist. Perhaps we should say visualize instead. So, to start astral travel, you should go to bed, alone, of course, and in a room alone, also. You should rest in any position whatsoever, so long as it is completely comfortable. If you could stand on your head, that would be quite all right, if you found it comfortable. But if you want to lie on your back, or on your side, on your front, so long as it is comfortable, that's all you need to do. If you find it comfortable, then that is all you need. So, lying down comfortably, make sure that your breathing is complete. That is, slow and deep and even, naturally, comfortably, not forced. Lie like that for a few moments, collecting your thoughts. Then, with the light out, visualize yourself as a body within a body. Visualize you are in a body withdrawing from your outer body, in much the same way as you would withdraw your hand from the glove which encompassed it. Form a mental picture of your body just as you are lying on the bed. Do you have pajamas on? Then visualize them, even to the stripes or the patterns or the flowers. Do you have a nightdress? Visualize that precisely as it is. Do you have pretty little bows and laces around your neck? Well, be sure you visualize them. Or, are you one of those hardy souls who sleeps like a peeled banana? Well, visualize yourself just as you are, and then go on with your visualization to imagine, visualize your astral form to be absolutely identical with the outer form. Visualize this body sliding out of the flesh body and rising up so that it's about an inch or two above the flesh body. Hold it there. Just concentrate on visualizing what it is like. If you're a girl, you'll have long hair. But that is a mistake because boys too seem to have long hair nowadays. But anyway, if you have long hair, visualize it hanging down. Is it touching the face of the flesh body? Then push it up a few inches. Visualize that body as a solid creation. Look at it from the top, from the ends, from underneath, so that you can get a complete picture, a solid picture of it. Then, let yourself feel satisfaction. You are out of the body. Do you feel the astral body swaying up and down slightly? Be careful. If it sways too much, you will have a dreadful feeling of falling, and then you'll slam back into your flesh body again with a horrid bonk, which will jerk you back to being just in bed. Be satisfied for the moment, thinking of your body, your astral body, floating a little way just above your flesh body. Then gradually visualize the astral body sinking back inside the flesh body, just as you would slide your hand into a glove. Try that for a night or two until you can hold the visualization strongly. And when you can do that, go further. You've gotten out of your body. You are floating just above your flesh body. Think, where do you want to go? Do you want to go and see Dr. Armand Legge, the doctor who gave you such a bad medical report or something? All right, you know what he's like. Think of him. Think of yourself traveling. Think of yourself arriving. If you can do it like this, you can just tickle him on the back of his neck. He will become frightfully uncomfortable. But perhaps it's a little unkind to tell you of a trick like that. Do you want to think of your girlfriend? Well, you can go and see your girlfriend too, if you want to. But remember, if you have the wrong thoughts in your mind about what you're going to see, you will find that until you've got an awful lot of practice, you'll end up back in your body with a hearty slap. What happens is this. You get out of your body. You think you will go and see some girlfriend or someone whom you'd like to have as a girlfriend. You know it's her bath time. And you want to see if she has any moles on her birthday suit. You get there, but her aura detects your presence and alerts her subconscious. Her consciousness may feel uneasy. She may keep looking over her shoulder or something. She may wonder if the landlord's peeping through the keyhole. She won't see you, but her aura will sense you, and the subconscious will rise and give you such a bunk that you will forget all that you've seen, and you'll be chased back to your body with more of a shock than you thought possible. Only when your thoughts are pure can you intrude on another person's privacy like this. And to those people who write in and ask how they can peep at their girlfriend at the wrong time, well, the answer is, for your own sake, don't. You'll get some pretty rough treatment. Practice this visualization. It's an easy thing indeed. When you can visualize it, then you can do it. So, how long is it going to take depends upon you, upon how quickly you can realize the truth. The truth is that you do astral travel, but because of civilized conditioning, etc., you do not always realize it. You do not always remember it. And when you do remember it, most times you pass it off as imagination or a dream or as wishful thinking. As soon as you accept the reality of astral travel, then you can sincerely visualize astral travel. And when you can sincerely visualize astral travel, then believe me, you can do it, because it is far more simple than getting up off a chair. It is far more simple than picking up a book. Astral travel is basic. It is part of a living person's birthright, no matter whether it be a horse, a monkey, a human, or a cat. Everyone does astral travel. But how quickly you do it consciously, well, that depends on you. Curiouser and curiouser, the very next question is, you say that in the astral, everything shimmers, but to me, everything shimmers always. Is it because they wear glasses? When you are in the astral, everything shimmers because it is full of life, full of vitality. If you are doing it properly, you can see little specks of light around you. You see as if everything was in a shaft of sunlight. No doubt you've been on some grimy railroad station and had a shaft of sunlight peer in through a murky window. In the shaft of sunlight, you have seen little specks floating about. Well, in the astral, everything is like that. You are in perpetual sunlight, and everything shimmers with the vitality of life. It is the opposite of being in smog. In the astral, by the way, bad sight does not occur. It does not matter if you are blind. In the astral, you have all your senses. You can hear and see. You can smell and you can feel. 100% efficiency every time. So why not try astral travel? It is easy and it is natural. And finally, astral travel is utterly, utterly safe. You cannot get hurt. And so long as you are not afraid, no harm of any kind can happen to you. If you are afraid, well, you're just wasting your energy. There is nothing to it except that. The only thing is, if you are afraid, you are dissipating your energy needlessly, and you are slowing down your vibration so much that you're making it difficult to stay in the astral, in the same way that an airplane that loses its forward speed sinks. You don't want to sink, do you? All right then, don't be afraid. There is nothing of which to be afraid. So the questions come rolling in ad infinitum. Add two and two together. The old typewriter goes clacking away and the pages come churning out. Not churning out really, because everything is thought out, but with a bit of practice, typing comes fast. And so the pages come out anyway, which means as there are more and more pages, there's less and less room for further questions. So Let us answer just one more question in this chapter, and here's a good one. You tell us that when we are on Earth, we are only 1/10 conscious, but from what we read in your books, it does appear that we are less conscious than our beings who inhabit other planets. The gardeners of the Earth is one example. Either are in possession of 100% awareness, or they must have greater power than Earth people. Or is it that, in their third-dimensional state, they could be more than 1/10 conscious? Their intellect and technical knowledge seem to be so far beyond ours, not only their intellect, but their compassion and understanding. Can you explain this, please? Yes, sure, nothing to it. On this Earth, we are upon one of the most measly of little dust spots in the universe. You see, there are more planets, more worlds, than there are grains of sands upon all the seashores of the Earth. And you can throw in, for good measure, all the sand on the seabed too, because the number of universes is beyond human comprehension. If you get a bit of dirt beneath your nail and you look at it all beneath a microscope, you find there are thousands of bits of dirt. But then, think of all the stuff on the surface of your body. Think also that no matter how this dirt appears to you, yet still it is formed of the basic carbon molecule. So piece of dirt beneath a nail, how are you going to imagine how many molecules, how many worlds there are in one human body? And having decided upon that, how about all the other human bodies, the animal bodies, the bodies on other worlds, etc.? Upon this world, we are 1/10 conscious, but upon other worlds, people may be several more tenths conscious. But if they were even 1/20 conscious, they would still be far more intelligent than the people of Earth. The gardeners of the Earth are not just three-dimensional people living somewhere out there in space, ready to slap down an intruding astronaut or cosmonaut. They are in a different dimension also. And, of course, their technical abilities are so far above that of humans that humans, to them, would be like a particularly scruffy microbe sitting on a particularly scruffy piece of dirt. The big difficulty is that upon this Earth, we have to live and deal with three-dimensional terms. So how is one to describe things which happen perhaps in 9 or more dimensions? So, to answer the question, yes, upon this Earth, we are only 1/10 conscious. And, yes, we are less conscious than our beings who inhabit superior planets, even if, by chance, they also should be only 1/10 conscious. Yes, the gardeners of the Earth are much more conscious, and they are also much more conscious in many more dimensions. They have worked their way up from what we are now, and yet above them there are higher beings, and to them the gardeners of the Earth are just as we appear to the gardeners of the Earth. But if we adopt the correct law, and that law is that we should do that which we would have others do unto us, then we too can climb our way up to the state of the gardeners of the Earth, and from thence onwards. The best way to explain it is to take the RAF motto, through hardship to the stars. End of chapter 11. Chapter 12. Henrietta Bunn glowered gloomily as she looked at her friend. "Can't understand this author," she complained. "Here am I, trying to study his books, and there's no index. How does he expect one to find a thing again? Read all the books?" Her breath trailed off into a series of muttered fulminations as she flipped the pages as well as her lid. Her friend, Frieda Preisner, smiled indulgently. "Well, you know, Hen," she replied, "I read his books for pleasure. The thought of study turns me off, and I want someone to turn me on." She sighed and added, "But you've got something there, girl. All books should have indexes, so you can look up what you want to avoid." The poor, wretched author groaned as he wriggled in discomfort on his hard steel bed. "What do people want?" he wondered. "First, it's a sin to use too many I's. And after all, am I not entitled to an I or two or more than average? There is the third I, you know. But now readers, bless their little hearts, one to each reader. They want an index." The old author felt his pangs and pains increase at the mere thought. Deep in the heart of the United States, where the buffaloes no longer roam, the elks having taken over instead, a most brilliant and talented woman was hard at work, with one husband, and she says it's enough, and two children, she says it's still too many as they are boys, to look after. She still found time to compile an index. Out of the blue it came. Well, no, this is a true book. Out of a mailman's mail sack it came. A package. The old author's fumbling fingers easily unwrapped the parcel because it had already been opened by Canada Customs, which is a very bad custom they have. Inside, yes, you guessed it, there was an index. Mrs. Mariah Peen is a brilliant woman, talented and capable, yet no one is perfect. Even she has a fault. Her writing is minute, and the old author has rapidly failing sight. So, to read Mrs. Peen's writing, a strong magnifying glass is used. She missed her vocation. Her natural work should be to write books on the head of a pin. "Thank you, Mrs. Peen, for your greatly appreciated work. And thank you, Miss Sakita Siamese Peen, for keeping her up to it." And, listeners, there follows an index to this book, which I'm not going to read, and that is the end of the 13th candle. Thank you for listening.